This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
Well, I bet you didn't expect this over the weekend as we're beginning another week here. The yogurt shop murders solved. So we're going to dig into this today. If you're unfamiliar with the case, we're going to familiarize you with it and the latest developments of what took place. Robin Dreek, retired FBI special agent, is going to join us in just a few moments. And we're going to go through what happened here and how we got to the place today and how there were four people, in addition to the four murdered children whose lives were essentially destroyed and ruined in the last 34 years. After 34 years, the infamous yogurt shop murders in Austin are now officially solved. The answer came not from a new witness, not from a last-minute confession, but from science. Advanced DNA testing and genetic genealogy, IGG, as you've heard it talked about in so many cases. They've identified Robert Eugene Brashears as the killer. He was a traveling serial predator back in the 90s, already linked to other murders across the country. He died by suicide back in 1999. Took modern technology to finally close the circle on a case that had haunted Austin for decades. But the real story isn't just who did it. It's what happened along the way. Four innocent young men were dragged through years of suspicion, false confessions, even wrongful convictions, even one ending up on death row because of interrogation tactics and tunnel vision that collapsed under the weight of better evidence. Families lived in limbo, reputations were destroyed, and trust in the system was shaken. So in this conversation, we're not retracing the crime. We're examining what the case teaches us. Robin Dreek, let's start breaking this down and how modern DNA changed the game, why investigators once saw it so wrong, and how bad interview techniques create false confidence, and most importantly, what reforms can make sure another community doesn't wait three decades for the truth. This weekend, I was in my kitchen cooking. I was making pasta sauce. And you texted me going, hey, look, they caught him. And again, I was not expecting that. But again, IGG, it's that DNA. Everybody putting their stuff in the ancestry and the 23andMe and all that. This led to another conviction. Are you surprised?
Yeah, I am surprised, but relieved and, yeah, and traumatized by it. Gang, because what, you know, when we looked at this a number of weeks ago, when you had mentioned it to me, so we're watching a series on HBO Max, yeah, and it's like you said, it's rather long series. And I remember when I first pulled up the series to look at it, because this goes to that answer, as you know, I get these long narrative answers. The most striking thing to me was were the cops involved in it back then, where they are now, and how destroyed their lives are now. I mean, you look at the one, these guys look like they're having a hard time recovering from living a very hard life. And I really think this case sent them down a path of that. A lot of pressure on them, on the community, to solve this crime because of the horrendous nature of it. It was so traumatic. Four girls killed inside a yogurt shop. No leads, behavioral analysis, zero there because all the things were burned up. So the behavior team came in and gave really nothing. And so then they go down this path of trying to make something happen. And thereby you get a really off interviewer, which is able to compel someone to confess to something and people that the things they didn't do by interjecting false memories, new memories, trauma. I mean, all these things were at play here. And at the end, what happened? Like you said, DNA exonerated everyone, even though they were all exonerated after that, after some time in jail, on death row, and the families. I'm just, this is just a path of destruction because you had one serial killer that was transient. How do you catch that? I mean, it was just, this is the perfect storm of horrible that I've ever seen in such a long time.
And that's a good question. How do you catch that? And at some points, I mean, obviously, it's much easier to look back at this 30 years later and go, well, here's all the things you could have done differently. But in 1991, it was very different. Just as I'm sure they'll look back today, maybe at some point, and say, well, the way you're doing things, we found better ways to do them. At least I hope they do, because that's growth. But if we look back at that point in time, I want to walk all the way back to the techniques as to what they were using. They wanted to find somebody. The community wanted, they wanted a villain. They wanted the monster that killed these girls. And of course they did. But there also needs to be the strength on the part of law enforcement, or there needed to be the strength on the part of law enforcement saying, if we don't have him, we don't have him. And we can't make one up if it's not him. And I don't know when you look at it full picture that they were consciously trying to make someone up or to create the boogeyman, but they sure found a way of getting false confessions. And I want to dive into all of that. Before we even do that, I think it'd be good for everybody to kind of get a taste as to what these interrogations looked like, because I want to talk about all of that with you, how this interrogating people has changed, why they thought this was a good idea at one point in time, and where we are today. Todd, let's roll that the clip. This is about 3 minutes, and this is kind of a greatest hits, if you will, of some of the interrogations that were taking place back in the early 90s with those the suspects in the yogurt shop murders. Let's take a look.
We want the truth, and you know what the truth is. You're having trouble with the memory, the flashback. You know what happened. You're scared to tell it. I don't blame you. Say the horrible thing, what you saw in there.
Look, can I tell y'all what I keep seeing in my head? Tell us what you think, man. I keep seeing these girls get shot.
Right.
Tell us what that looks like. Tell me when you see it specifically. How they're getting shot and who's shooting them. Come on, I've been doing good. Tell us. Let's do this today. We'll do it.
Seeing girls. I remember seeing them down. I remember one girl screaming, terrified.
Okay.
I don't know if this is real or not, or if this is Michael, it's real.
It's okay. You can present it to me the way you want.
It's real. Michael, look at me. You're remembering what happened.
So you were inside there, right?
I don't.
You're remembering what happened.
I don't obviously remember going in the building.
But you were in the building.
You were in there with me.
I don't believe that, Michael. You don't remember what was there.
And you know you were in there.
Did you shoot anything real?
No, sir.
Then tell us what happened. What are those two women doing to those girls? You want to live with this the rest of your life?
No, I don't.
Then get it out right now. They're you over. They're the ones that shot the girls. Do it. What did you see happen?
At some point, Maurice handed you that revolver. What did he say to you?
Either shoot him or you're next.
That's what he said.
Because I didn't want to do it.
Right. Either shoot him or you're next. What do you remember hearing this?
I remember looking at this girl. I cry. I hear Robert saying, do it, do it. I hear the gun go off. I only pulled the trigger once. I turn around. Here's your stupid gun.
What happened next, Mike? That brought back some memories, didn't it? I remember looking at the gun. You ever seen that gun before? I'm not positive. Does that look like a gun you've seen before?
It looks like a gun I've seen before, but I'm not positive.
Is that the gun you shot somebody with, Mike?
I don't.
Is that the gun you walked up behind somebody with and shot in the head? Is that the one? Talk to me, Mike.
Yes,
you did that, didn't you?
Yes, sir.
We've installed some more doors, haven't we, Mike?
Not really.
You sure?
Yes, sir.
So that's some of the police interrogation techniques that were used back in 1999 on some of these kids. Robin, what's your reaction when you see how that went down? What are you seeing?
So it's interesting. I've seen those tactics before pretty frequently, actually, because there's a lot of leading questions. I mean, you're an interviewer, you know that. There's a lot of leading questions there. And there's a lot of presumed knowledge on the behalf of the cops. But here's where, as I was really thinking about this as I'm watching this, because what they're doing is not necessarily off of what they've been trained to do and what you do when you're getting confession. But here's where there's a huge disconnect, a massive disconnect. You typically use a very confrontational way after you have, and you've used what's called rationalizations, projections, and minimizers, RPMs. You help them rationalize their behavior. You project the blame onto others, like you're a victim of the circumstance around you, and minimize it. Hey, you only killed two girls. It could have been much worse. You could have killed five. Four girls. See what I mean? Yeah. So those are the things you do to try to help them walk up to the cliff, as they say, before pushing you over. Because pushing them over that psychological cliff is doing what he's doing right there, where you're very accusatory, you're trying to nail down timelines. But here's where the massive flaw in this is. You only do that when you are actually sure and 100% confident on the things you're saying. Mm-hmm. In other words, you have evidence that they actually did do this. You can actually walk them through the timeline that you've established, and they're now going to admit to what you've already know that it happened. Mm-hmm. That is typically the way it's done. So what they did was they took a wild-ass guess that they're the ones that did it and how it was and how it happened, and they're now placing it onto them. And the way our memories work, and they did a great job in the series describing our memories work in packets. Mm-hmm. And what they're doing is he's using superimposing events. And when you hear something in the news and you hear it on TV or you hear it somewhere else, when you get a time separation from it, you can't remember whether I lived it or didn't. I mean, we do this all the time. I think if you're a visual person in particular, if you read a book and it was a really, really good book, and you tend to be visual, a lot of times you give it some time passage between the time you read the book and like a couple years away from the event, you have a hard time, if it's well written, to remember if you saw it as a movie or read it as a book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right.
So it's the same thing here. So these people are going to have known about the case, known about some circumstances of the case, and now this cop is telling them that they were part of it, and he's leading them down the path of creating the linkages. He was very effective at getting I've never seen a more effective way to get a false confession. But it was flawed because he didn't know it was them. And he's getting them and he's placing false memories, doing linkages between these packets, and they're separated by time, as we've seen in many other cases. And it's a disaster.
I mean, it's very interesting to watch. And we go back to 1999. Was this being trained? I mean, was this what they were being trained to do? Were they doing the best they could, I guess, is my question. At that moment in time, was this the way that they believed would be the most effective to getting an accurate confession out of people? And have we since learned differently since? Or were they already behind the times and this is just how they were doing it back then here in Austin?
So the fact that I've seen this done says that it's not a wrong technique if mm-hmm. you know that they've done the crime and you're trying.
Not using it correctly.
Yeah, and here's the other thing too. So the other thing that struck me about this was the fact that they're using a very empathetic methodology, meaning that they're relying on the fact that this person that they're interviewing and interrogating has empathy towards their victims, has empathy towards other human beings. They're playing on their emotional response to these things. And the problem here is if you have someone that just killed four people, they're most likely high psychopathy. They're not going to respond to those techniques. And so it's going to be very accusatory on here's the facts we have. So it's an emotional way to compel someone to admit something they didn't do. If you're dealing with someone who actually just murdered someone or is being accused of someone, and you actually have the facts and data, you're going to lead them down the path where they incriminate themselves more effectively, like saying, "Hey, listen, you say you didn't do it. All right, so help me understand this. Now you lay about a piece of evidence. Tell me this. Mm-hmm. All right, then tell me how come your fingerprint was on this. If this was what you say you were on this certain date and time, then how come I have this?" You know, so that's where you kind of confront them with their lies once you got them over that edge. And so you're going through the process of facts and data with having them try to explain away through more elaborate lies. And that's when it all falls apart. And that's when you say, listen, we can do it an easy way and a hard way, not for me, but for you. You know, here's what sentences are in typical cases like this. You're looking at life, looking at death, or we can make myself an advocate for you and bring some resolution to these families if that's something that means something to you. But if you want to just fry, we can go that way. So you tell me what path you want to go down. And so that's when you kind of lead them up to the edge. Here's what I got. I got more. We can keep going down where there's inconsistency between what you say and what evidence I have, or you can just share with me your story, get your story out there, because what really matters is not what I think. What matters is what happened according to you. So let's do this together. So that's how, see how I did that? It's a lot different than saying, bop, 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 bop.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, you're using facts and data.
I have a question, Robin, and I don't want to derail the conversation in any way, but this is going to get a little personal. As a parent, have you used these tactics on your kids? Because as teens, they push things. So I'm curious, because I'm sitting here, I'm thinking back to times when I did something naughty as a teen and my mom knew I did it.
Right.
And I was being led down that path. Like, she knows, I can tell she knows, and she's heading in that direction. Did you ever use these immense skills of interrogation on your kids?
So I rule.
I mean, other people have to be asking this too.
Robin has a little room in his house with just a light hanging from it and a table. And his kids, it's like, it's time to come into the daddy room. We got to talk.
So there's a philosophy of life that I live when I was working and in everything I do. And that is, how do you inspire someone to tell the truth before they have an opportunity to lie? And so that's what elicitation is. And so you can leak out, hey, here's some facts and data. I know you, and I know you really well. I know you don't want to do something that's going to hurt you, and definitely don't want to hurt our relationship. Here's a great opportunity, without judgment, of helping me understand, because you normally make a lot of really great, healthy decisions. This looks like a situation that might have deviated from that. Help me understand what led you up to make this choice and decision, so we can kind of work on this together, if that's something you're comfortable with. Mm-hmm. So that's how I typically engage. But when my kids were really young, here's what I did. It was the most effective thing ever. I told my kids, I said, hey, dad works for the FBI and I'm a behavior guy. And here's a special technique I have. I can tell if someone's been lying or not if they stick out their tongue. And I'd say to my kids, I said, Kevin, let me see your tongue. And she went like this. I said, aha, you're going to lie. I said, don't lie to me, Kevin. I can tell.
I like it.
I love that. Thank you for answering that. Because the entire time I'm like, I can't imagine using these skills in your real life. Not that you'd have to, but, you know, who took the last cookie and the kids got crumbs on their mouth going, I didn't do it. You've got skills, man.
So it's about never judging the choices they make. And that's what I did in my job. And it's what I do in life. I do that in everything with each other. I mean, it's like understanding the context, walk a mile in someone else's shoes to see what decisions you would make. And so what I did with my kids and I do with everyone is help me understand, walk me in your shoes and I'll take mine off to put yours on and let's go down this path together. And then once I start understanding without judging the choices you made, then we can start making some choices together on the best path forward. And I can play forward from my experience for you, the cause and effect of your actions that you took. And we can try to mitigate them together the best way we can possibly can. Now, granted, that methodology I just laid out for how we inspire someone to share information that might not be in their best interest to share, that's what I call confession, works with people that are empathetic, that are not outside of, that are not super outside of parameters of normal behavior. This works with people that was a crime of passion, that was a moment of losing control of, and they generally have a slightly more abilities for regulation. So here's what that wouldn't work with. Koberger, pure psychopath. Those words mean nothing. They roll right off. The only thing that works with someone that's edging up more on psychopathy is that grandiosity. Is like, listen, kind of like Olivia Consalvis did with him. It's like, you kind of suck. Matter of fact, you just don't kind of suck. You definitely suck. You're the worst thing I ever saw. You said you wanted to be this great individual. I'll tell you what, you got one opportunity to kind of prove to me that you are as great as you think you are. Tell me how you're better than, and then you rattle off all the people he idolized. Mm-hmm. And if you can't do it, then you know what? You're just another punk and you sucked at everything you did.
Yeah.
A wholly different tactic on, because that's the only thing that resonates with psychopathy is grandiosity. And so they're kind of, and so I give it to the cops. Maybe, I don't know if they thought this hard about it. They're dealing with the people they are interviewing. These were not psychopaths. They were using an empathetic approach to interviewing and interrogating, But if someone killed four kids, it wouldn't match. See what I mean? There's an incongruence between who they're talking to and the methodology and techniques. But so now to get to the original question, training. There's not a lot of training. You'd think that, you know, people that are in law enforcement go through the most advanced training and techniques there are in the world. But really, the best training there is you're introduced to a baseline of how to talk to a human being, whether it's a read technique for interviewing. And we talked at length about this in the last couple of weeks, a Socratic method about how to interview someone by asking a lot of questions, discovery questions, as we call. But the only way you really get good at it is doing it a lot, then reflecting on what was a good, what wasn't effective, what was more effective, doing it with a partner so the partner can debrief you as well. Because when you're going to be a really good interviewer and a really good interrogator and getting someone to inspire them to share something that's not in their best interest, the last thing you do is show them their shame. And the first thing you do is you have to be able to meet them where they are at their tempo, at their thing. And then you have to be able to match it to your own personality, your own delivery style about how you present yourself. It's very individualistic. You only get good at it when you do it. How does someone become a master? Was it 10,000 hours, 10,000 reps? And so to throw someone in there and they've only done something. So here's the other thing too. If you've only done something one way your entire career, the likelihood of your flexibility to do it another way is slim to none. If you've only done this type of interview and interrogation once or if never in your career, what's the likelihood you're going to be good at it? Slim to none. Yeah. So all those things play in. I'm sorry, long answer as always.
No, I think one of the biggest questions that people have about false confessions, especially when it comes to something like this, is how does someone give it? Michael Scott gave it. You had, and not Michael Scott from The Office, literally the guy's name was Michael Scott. He was pressured into giving up Robert Springsteen, that he was part of it, and then the two of them were convicted together, all on things that never took place.
I know.
He was convinced, or I mean, tell me, was he convinced when they were going through this process? Was Michael Scott literally believing that he did not remember these things and they were coming back to him in this police interrogation? Or was it as simple as the explanations that are thrown out there? Well, they were tired. They were exhausted. They just wanted to get out of there. I don't know that I would, again, I've never been in this situation, but I don't know that I would ever be confessing to a murder just to get away from more questions. You look at like the Richard Allen interview. He never, ever confessed to it until he was literally, mentally broken as a human being after more than a year of being sitting in a solitary confinement chamber being tortured. These are kids in a police interrogation for quite some time. I mean, many, many hours, but that's quite a thing to give up and quite a thing to say. Keep in mind, it's a young mind too. These are teenagers at this moment.
Yeah.
So, a little, I guess, more meldable, but I guess that's the big question. My long question is, how and why did they ever get to the point of saying that they did this if they didn't do it? And clearly they didn't do it. Right. So how did they get there?
So I had to do a lot of research on this too, because I don't deal in the world where you get a lot of false confessions. Mm-hmm. And we saw with the Richard Allen case, and he was very clearly, to me, the isolation aspect, and that goes to the stress and exhaustion. Totally, that plays into it. So, like you're saying, the teenagers here, not necessarily in that realm. I think the playing on the guilt most likely was an aspect of the skin. This is wholly guessing because we don't know. As I've tried to do a deeper research on these four individuals in life, I mean, the life afterwards, and they're wrecked people. And I think they might have been going down a path back then of that as well, because one of the things that makes you more susceptible is, I think, age, because before the prefrontal lobe's fully formed up to like 23, 24, your impressibility is very, very high. And when you have a person of an authority figure, you know, impressing on you what happened and from their context, and they're explaining away your memory issues. I've seen this before with counselors. I've known counselors that were dealing with people's trauma, telling them that one of the reasons they have trauma is because they have an issue with their mother, because their mother must have sexually abused them growing up. And I've seen counselors tell people that you don't remember it because it's so traumatic. And so now this person now believes they were sexually abused by their mother. Completely fiction. Mm-hmm. Because, and that's what this guy is doing here. He's taking memory gaps, or not even memory gaps, a lack of a memory, and explaining it away to them at, in a position of authority, so that now it becomes a new memory. He's taken a small segment of, you've seen a gun, you've seen this gun before, but you've seen a gun like this. Well, you've seen a gun like this, it must have been this gun. So he's leading them down the path of creating a new memory. It's
does the interviewer really know that that's what he's doing at that moment in time in this case? I mean, I get, like, if you were to use this for nefarious purposes and look back on it going, oh, well, here's how you could elicit that. But I'm wondering, at the point in time, these investigators, these interviewers that are doing this, obviously they want to get to the bottom of this. I can't in the, my heart believe that they're trying to make these kids make things up. I think they genuinely think they're getting legitimate answers.
Yeah. So their methodology of hunting for someone back then, especially, I mean, think about this now, the likelihood of something like this happening now is so much less, because what they didn't have in this investigation was Ring cameras. They didn't have cell phones to triangulate and be able to say how many people were actually in that shop that night, be able to get cell phone data. There's DNA. There's so many things that they didn't have. All they had was interviews, and their only methodology they had in this small town was, who looks odd? Really, that's what that did. They brought in people that looked odd, that didn't fit that norm of behavior, what they thought normal, healthy people would do. So they only interviewed people that were unhealthy people and people that stood out from a norm. And so that became, it must be one of them. Mm-hmm. And so if we started getting a little inkling of what we think it is, in other words, they did really, really no science of profiling, because the profilers didn't give anything on this, because they said all the evidence was destroyed because of the fire. Mm-hmm. So they're coming up with their own conjecture on who they thought it was. It must be someone odd. So they created a filter of only odd people and only odd people. So let's think about this. Odd people, when you're looking at a societal norm for a region, there's going to be some, I'm not saying mental health issues, but there's going to be some issues of not feeling like you fit in, not feeling connected, and maybe mental issues as well. And so their brains might be a little more susceptible. So this guy's all playing on this. Now, do I think he's sitting there and saying, I'm going to get a false confession? No. Mm-hmm. But he's going to grab on to what he thinks is someone's got leakage on the fact that they did it. And his only use and his only evidence is the fact that they're different from this societal norm in our culture right here.
And this is 1991. This is Austin, Texas. This is, I mean, and I will say, if you weren't alive in 1991, people, odd folks stood out more. I don't know another way to say it. Odd stood out. Now we live in a culture where everybody can kind of be who they are. I mean, in many ways, far more than they could in 1991. I'll put it that way.
And you wouldn't give it a second glance.
Yes. And so you have a lot of folks where it's like, well, this is odd, because everybody's kind of in their own smaller tribes, I would say, than they were in 1991. So the kids from the wrong side of the tracks that look a little spooky did stand out a bit more, you know, than they, I guess, would have today. So it was easier to point the finger and go, well, you look different, so you're spooky. You must have something nefarious going on, because you listen to the hard rock and you wear the heavy metal t-shirts. It was satanic panic time. All that stuff was going on. So a very understanding the mindset, it was very different back then as well. But of course, like, not everybody who looks a little different is out for nefarious intent. In fact, most of the time they're not. So it was a very different place in time than what we have today, in terms of folks like that standing out. And then I guess, you know, also preconceived notions on, well, they must be up to no good. I would imagine that all played into this as well.
You look different. We're a very judgy society at that time. And four girls are dead. It must be you. And I just got to figure out how to get you to confess to it.
And how, let me ask you this. How confusing is it for an investigator when you do get the false confession? They weren't very versed in psychology at all on how any of this worked. They were there to get them to say the words, I did it.
Right.
And when they eventually do get someone saying, I did it, if you think that you got it through legitimate means and you're completely unaware that it's not, you're going to Why would this person say this if it's not true? Maybe I did find the person, even though I kind of led them down this road. Then you have that in the back of your mind going, well, I did get them to say it. So why would they say it? I wouldn't say it if I was doing it. Then you get that, you know, their own storyline trying to play against someone else's storyline of confessing or not confessing. So it's confusion all around, I think, for a lot of people, including the investigators.
So they all got caught up in the culture of wanting to solve this and not being investigators, not exploring all the inconsistencies. Because every time you have an inconsistency, that's something you need to explore. Mm-hmm. And so what typically happens in cases like this, in any case, is, all right, so you're willing to confess. All right, now you got to write it out. Mm-hmm. And the first time they try to write out their confession and you then have everyone that they say was involved write out their confession, isolated from each other, all of them are going to be different.
Yeah.
Because it's not a real memory. And so right there as an investigator, as a prosecutor, all right, so say you're an investigator. Investigators are really at the granular level. They're very close to the case. They have their own confirmation biases, and that's why we have co-case agents. That's why we have supervisors. And more importantly, that's why we have prosecutors that know what's going to be admissible in court and what it's going to look like to a jury. And when you actually have confessions, all right, we got confessions, and you have four of them that are – like a shotgun spread, that as a prosecutor saying, yeah, we need to go back and look at this some more. But this wasn't happening because then you have the societal pressure to solve the case. You have you have crying parents. You have a community that's afraid that there's a killer still out there. You have all the external factors that are driving this, which makes it the perfect storm. And all because this guy, from what I think, in this time period, was uncatchable. Mm-hmm. And when you look at the stats of unresolved crimes and murders, it's just be another one. And there's, what is it? Like, I looked up all these stats. You know, I do. It's like 3,000 or 4,000 murders a year are unsolved.
Yeah. And there was no IGG back then. There was
this
no
guy was, it's called a hybrid serial killer, you know, half planned, half impulsive. And he was transient. Like you said, how the hell do you catch, you know, because they kept looking. I mean, the fatal flaw in this was they're looking at, and it's not because they were fatally flawed, just because there's nothing else to do. They're looking at their own community. Mm-hmm. He wasn't there. He was out in and out in a blink of an eye. This was a target of opportunity because how did this guy target people from now that we know who it was? Mm-hmm. He targeted women that were isolated, that were standing alone, that, you know, was good skin. Predators don't go for hard targets. They don't, you know, that's why they hit churches. That's why they hit females late at night, isolated in yogurt shops where no one is, you know, strip malls that are about to close up. You know, they don't go for the hard targets where everyone's going to see them. They go for the soft, and that's what this guy was doing. He's transient. He's moving across the southeast and the south, and he's hitting what he's considering from his soft, easy targets. How do you catch that?
Especially at that point in time, the technology wasn't there to do it. And there's, you know, there's thousands and thousands and thousands of unsolved murders that are still out there that are slowly coming to the surface because of IGG. I mean, look at the Golden State Killer and things of that nature that were all caught, you know, using that sort of technology.
Ted Kaczynski, the Unabomber, if it hadn't been for the brother recognizing the handwriting, the Unabomber, well, he'd probably be dead by now anyway. But I mean, the path of destruction would continue because there's someone actually was able to hide. And because he didn't do it for ego. I'm sorry. We'll get a whole different thing. He knew how to hide is a better way to put it, because he was a planned and calculated individual that left no digital or any kind of forensic footprint. And how did he do it? He had to dive under rocks or live in a shack in a cabin in the middle of nowhere and have zero interaction with the outside world. That's the only way.
Yeah. And he didn't worry about, well, I got to turn my cell phone off. He didn't need the cell phone.
Nope,
he was doing it the real way of being out there. When investigators went into this and in these interrogations, you know, it feels like they're going in, they're trying to crack the nut, essentially. Let's get to what we think we're going to get here. And let me ask you this. When you're going in to interrogate someone, when you're going in to try and find what what you want to, you know, not necessarily you want to be the truth, but you're trying to get to the truth. I think that's a big difference there. To the truth or want to get to what you believe is the truth. You have to go and not necessarily knowing what the truth is if you don't truly know what this person is up to. How do you recognize when there's nothing to crack in that nut, when you're sitting there and you're asking questions? Obviously, people can sit there and they're going to be difficult, and it can take a long time in interrogation to get actual, you know, results and actual answers. But at what point do you go and what sort of signs do you look for and say, this isn't our person? And what did they miss here in this with these, the four guys that they were going after for all of that time? What were they missing here in terms of the signs that they should have looked at and said, these aren't our guys?
It's hard to walk a mile in the shoes of the investigators at the time.
Yeah.
But the first question I asked in all the espionage investigations I always did was, what, you know, the first question you ask as an investigator is, what would compel this individual that I think might have done it to do it? And then in order to answer that question, you start looking at the behavior arc. You know, so tell me where they grew up. Tell me about the home life. Tell me about the upbringing. Tell me about if they have healthy, happy relationships in their lives, or they don't have healthy, happy relationships in life. The fact that these people were friends, well, that's a shot against them being the ones that did it, because it's kind of unusual. So I'm always looking at the behavior arc, because if all of a sudden, because we do this all the time, if these four individuals don't have a background and a history of escalating violence, anger, emotional instability, ability to self-regulate their emotions, all these things, if all four aren't escalating towards a moment of doing this type of violence, the likelihood of me going down a track and bringing them in to interrogate them in that way is slim to none. I can't imagine me doing it. But then again, I'm not I wasn't a homicide detective doing it, but I've done this so many times before where I would have these cases referred to me on, because again, I worked counterintelligence, so I'm the espionage guy. Every time a case got referred to me as a potential for espionage where they betrayed their country, and a lot of times they've done other heinous things, the first question I always asked was, from the people around them in their lives, the first thing you do is you interview people, tell me about them. And I'd always ask my opening questions, tell me about what you think about the individual. Do you like them? And if they said, if they're in tears because, oh my God, he's such a good guy, I can't imagine he'd ever do this, likelihood of you having your guy goes down drastically. And if I have not just one person, but now multiple people tell me what a good person this is, and that, you know, you just, you know, all these data points are telling me the likelihood of this being the person, probably not there. Because from all these people in your life thinking that you're a good, healthy person, and then you have four people having that same kind of reaction, that arc is not the arc that's going to spike out of, all right, I'm going to go kill four people right now, four girls. Mm-hmm. There's got to be a history. There's got to be something. And also, and if it's a community like this, you're going to be, because what they should have been doing too, that who knows if they were or weren't, you're looking for connection. Mm-hmm. It is, and I know this is the one of the 5% of the cases out there, I think it's 5 or 10%, where there's not some sort of connection to either the yogurt place or the victims between the killer. Very, very rare. And so those are other things I'm looking at. So there's so many data points that should have been brought in and looked at and examined before they brought them into an interrogation room, an interview room, which always starts out as an interview before you bring them up to the ledge, before you make an accusatory statement. They accused hardcore right in there without any of those, with inconsistencies, all those data points. It just didn't make sense to me.
Isn't there I'm trying to think back to when this all kind of began in my brain. Like I ask a question sometimes of people that talk about somebody who is really a good person. It's like, have you looked in their freezer to make sure there's not any severed heads? You know, because it always seems like it's somebody that you see those, you know, reports on the news, oh, they were always such a wonderful person, I can't imagine that they did this, but yet they did it. So how do you reconcile with what you just talked about? Because obviously you know what you're doing, but doesn't it always seem like it's the one person you would never suspect?
Sometimes gaps. So it's the people that generally say that are the neighbors next door that see you 5%, you know, that you see their 5-second highlight reel. When they come out, to go to work in the morning. They come home at night. You might see them for snippets of time on the weekends. So what I'm looking for then is I'm looking for people that are actually close, that spend 90% of their time with them. What are they saying? What's their arc? And also, who are they? Because I also going to take in not just what they're saying about the individual. I want to see what they're saying about themselves as well. So I understand, hey, if you have a lot of unhealthy things going on your life, you're addicted to drugs, you're addicted to alcohol, you got a lot of trauma and you've been abused in your entire life. And you're saying, you know, Joe Schmuckatelli is a great guy. Well, now I can understand what that reference point is compared to you. So I need to understand who I'm interviewing, the depth of field of knowledge they have of the individual, the kind of relationships they typically have in their life, because that's giving me this is a thing that you get through life reps, is that every time I'm looking at one individual, I'm trying to understand, in order to understand them, I'm not just talking to everyone around them. I have to understand everyone around them at the same level I'm understanding them, because I'm understanding the entire intricate network of everyone around them to understand them at a more deep level, because I have to give them kind of a reference point on the information I'm getting. Are they, in other words, if someone says someone's a good person, but they're actually unhealthy people themselves, unhealthy looks healthy to the other person. Mm-hmm. So I got to understand that. So it's not simple.
Joe Schmuckatelli is a good guy, by the way.
You like that Joe Schmuckatelli?
I want to vouch for Joe Schmuckatelli.
Thank you, Robin.
Salt of the earth guy.
Generally he is.
Obviously, we look back on this now. I mean, we are looking at it back now going, well, these were really bad techniques that were being used. But is there anything out there today that says can't use those techniques? Are there any rules or standards I know the answer to this, but I don't know that the general public does. To say that you can't do these sort of tactics today, and are they still being used in certain places?
I think they are, again, because I've seen this used, and it can be effective if you actually know you have the guy that did it. but you don't. So the thing is, it's a very crude, crass way to go about it, because you're putting yourself against the individual. I mean, in all situations, what you're trying to do is you're trying to become someone that this individual can rely upon to be your confessor. Mm-hmm. It's really, because that's what it comes down to. So think about this.
But would you, I don't mean to interrupt you.
Go ahead.
Would you use this tactic on someone, or these tactics on someone, if you don't know that they are the killer? If you don't have that piece of information, you're still trying to get to it.
No, definitely not.
Yeah.
Definitely not. So that's a much, much simpler question that I probably can answer. No, you definitely wouldn't, because it serves no purpose. I mean, so here's the thing too. So say you think these people either did it or might be connected to someone who did it, because now you're doing that unhealthy profiling of people that they were doing back then to do this. The last thing you want to do is make an enemy or an adversary from the person that might be connected to the person that did it.
Yeah,
because if now you make an ally and this person actually isn't the person that did it, wouldn't it be better than to leave them feeling better for having met you? So when they go back to their group, say, you know what? I didn't do it, but I kind of got an inkling who did do it. If you're going to maybe do something to get over this or do something, this cop is a good guy. Go talk to this cop. So what law enforcement always wants to do is also not just be the person that finds you, but also be the person you want to go to. Because again, you want to be the confessor. You know, to Stacy's point earlier, you know, with my own kids, I wanted to be the person they felt safe to talk to.
Yeah.
You know, even when something went sideways, because when someone feels safe to share with you, the only way they're going to share with you is if they know they can share. You're not going to necessarily agree with them, but you're going to help them work that problem together, because it was a moment of stupidity. And hey, people do stupid things. Let's do this together so we can move you through the stupid thing. Because if we don't do it together, it's only going to get worse from here. Mm-hmm. And so that's where they also failed, because they didn't know they did it. And they're made in an adversarial relationship. They got a false confession from four different people. I mean, what a recipe for stupid. I understand it, but it makes no sense.
Yeah.
And then, I mean, you have to walk back too. I mean, if you're, you know, you're still an active, you know, law enforcement member, and then, well, it turns out that your tactics there led to a false confession that you know, that's some pride that you have to kind of walk back to and go, well, maybe that didn't work out so well. And people aren't always the greatest at changing their ways of doing things or their tactics. But then that's where training comes in. And I think that's the shocking part of a lot of this. The reality is a lot of law enforcement doesn't have a lot of training, especially when you get to smaller departments and even larger departments too. I mean, you know, can we speak to that? I mean, why don't we? I mean, the training, obviously, in different sorts of law enforcement varies dramatically from the FBI to a local law enforcement. I mean, educate us on that a little bit, just how different it is and who we're relying on in a lot of these local jurisdictions to get to the bottom of the truth. And how many more tools do a lot of these people even have beyond just the average citizen?
So the first question that really needs to be answered on this one, and we've seen it, I mean, talking about the last 5-10 years of policing, the training costs money.
Yeah.
That's the easiest answer right there, is training costs money. And so no money, no training. That's the number one challenge and problem to overcome. The next one is, who trained you? Because training doesn't, I mean, I'm an avid reader of a lot of things.
Yes.
I have stacks and stacks of books that give me all the education I need, but education without practice doesn't go anywhere. You need the practice to give you the wisdom, and wisdom comes from reps, and reps should be accumulated when you have the education through the training, which gives you the baseline of where to start. But in order to make it yours, in order to be able to do these things, you need to partner with someone who is a senior teacher, mentor, and guide who has the reps, who can take that art form and take that paint by number that you just learned, and they can teach you how to make art that fits you. So the second problem is not just the funding for the training, but the lack of experience of any teachers, mentors, and guides that have the life reps of having done these things who can sit with you and say, hey, why don't we take a break? Why don't we slow down? And you pull Robin, hey, come with me for a second. Hey, when you're doing this in there, wasn't going anywhere, was it? And why was that? Well, you might not have done it. I mean, did you think about this? Did you do this? Did you do this? So let's go back in. Let's recalibrate ourselves. Let's re-engage. Mm-hmm. And think about how we can inspire this person to want to share information with you rather than trying to convince them to do something that they don't think is in their best interest. Mm-hmm. That's what a teacher, mentor, and guide does. But if you don't have that, your force doesn't have that because people are quitting, they're retiring, they're getting out because it's such an adverse environment, whatever the reasons are, you get situations like this where their only experience getting confessions was using this methodology. Perhaps they guessed right that they actually had someone that actually had committed the crime. They use the same methods and techniques to get this person to confess. And now they think, I'm God. This is the method that works. I'm going to use it this way again. Mm-hmm. And no one's there to refute them because no one else has that experience.
And then you get what you get.
You get what you get.
Yeah.
It is an art form.
It is. And with this being, you know, I guess it's baffling to the general public, to civilians on some of this, because I think sometimes we have these ideas in our mind. Oh, this is how it works. This is what's going on behind the curtain. And it's safer and it's easier for us to sit there and go, oh, of course, they're really doing this behind the scenes. They got their stuff together. And it's even more disturbing when it turns out, no, they don't.
Tony, here's the greatest analogy everyone can identify with. Tony, how long have you been doing interviewing?
A long time, decades.
Were you ever taught how to do a radio show and interview someone?
By watching. I don't think I mean like sat down and somebody said, here's how you interview someone.
Yeah, nobody did that.
No.
And so you didn't have training.
No.
You have reps. And so it shouldn't be a shock to anyone that, hey, it's the same thing in law enforcement. You don't go. I remember when I went through the FBI Academy, it's like at the time, I think it's 6 or 9 months long. And you go through blocks of instruction for how to conduct an investigation, how to do an interview. We had our interviewing blocks. We had our firearms blocks. And I remember when you get to the field and you're going to start being an FBI agent and you're going to go out on your first interview. And I was 29 years old. And do you really think I learned something in the course of a couple months of training and probably about 8 hours, 8 or 16 hours of instruction in a classroom about how to interview someone, and I'm going to go from 0 to 100 to be the world's best interviewer? Or am I going to rely upon my 29 years of experience of being a human being first? Mm-hmm. What happens is we get training to give labels and meanings to behaviors we're already doing in our lives so we can recognize them as being effective or isn't effective, so we know what to enhance, so we know what to suppress, and we know what to add to ourselves. And so what we get through training is the ability to self-learn, self-master, because that gives us that baseline. And so if we don't have that in a couple months, in your experience, and most of our experience in life, is we find a passion for what we do and we get life reps in here so we can actually become very fluid. It becomes very natural part of who we are. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've said this to you numerous times, both on air and off, that I think you're one of the greatest interviewers because you are so fluid. I have no idea how you do it because you have so many life reps and years and decades of doing just this. You flow with it. You move with it. When I do these news hits, whether it's on Fox or News Nation or anywhere else, it's so easy for me to see who's got reps, mm-hmm. who doesn't have reps by how they're interviewing me, because, and it doesn't because they went to a great school and they went to a better school about how to interview someone. It's because they actually have the life reps. And most importantly, the ones that are have the greatest humility to realize that they're constant students and always learning and getting better, those are the ones that are great at this. But if you start thinking that I got this, mm-hmm. like this guy, this cop, I'm not saying what he did or didn't do.
Sure.
If he thinks, and I heard in one interview, he was labeled as a guy who could get a confession from anyone.
It's not a good, it's probably not a good rep, to, not a good reputation to have.
If you fall in love with your own legend, you're screwed.
Yeah. If you're the one that's getting confessions from everybody, not everybody has a confession to give.
Correct. Right.
And so that's how this works. And that's why I think we sometimes fall short on our expectation of law enforcement, because you think that there's some magic bullet that you're not getting. No, mm-hmm. here's a magic bullet. They have an opportunity to interview a lot of people, more than the average citizen does. That's where they get their life reps. And that's, you know, the life arc. I mean, think about this. Investigative reporters are another great one. I remember there was a person that wanted to come on my behavior team. They're an FBI agent. They had been in the FBI only a couple of years. And typically, you only had people on my behavior team. You need at least 5 to 10 years of experience first of being an agent. Mm-hmm. You can even entertain bringing on a team. I'm interviewing this person to come on the team. And I said, so what'd you do before you came in the bureau? And they said, oh, I was an investigative reporter. I said, really? How many interviews did you actually do before you came in the bureau? And he goes, oh, I don't know. Let's see. I was an investigative reporter for 5 years. I interviewed 365 days a year because that was a job. You interviewed or you died. And I did typically 3 to 5 interviews a day. And I'm like saying, you're in. Think about that.
Yeah.
3 to 5 interviews a day, 365 days a year for 5 years. That's reps.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You're on.
No. I didn't realize there would be a math test during this, Robin. I just want
to. And you know who that person was? Joe Schmuckatelli.
Yeah. Joe Schmuckatelli. Absolutely.
Joe Schmuckatelli.
I want to know if he exists.
Why is it? I mean, does it just come down to money? I mean, again, we have so many problems in our country where it's like, and it's not funded. And that's why we do things the way and they're not the most effective. Is this just another one of them? I mean, there's other countries that look at the way that we do interrogations and interviews and are horrified. Like their police forces are like, that's not how you get to the truth. Why do we never change anything? Why don't we have standards across the board of here's how we're going to do it? Is the answer simply cash?
Sometimes. That's why I say sometimes.
Yeah.
Also organizations, some organizations value training, some don't. And so the organizations that don't value training typically have a problem with ego.
Yeah.
Because in order to say I need training, you have to say I don't have all the answers. I'm not perfect. I'm flawed. I can continue to learn more.
Which every organization should say that.
Ah, that word should.
Should, yes. Everything should always be like, let's get better. Nobody should be like, we're perfect. If everything had that attitude, yeah. I mean, but you're asking an organization to have the, organizations can't have an attitude. It's the people within the organization that have the attitude.
Culture.
Exactly. Yep. I was going to say that, yep. We've been in some cultures where they think they're perfect. Mm-hmm. And you just look around and go, oh my God, you are the most flawed I've ever seen. So
I think it was Simon Sinek, and he wrote it in Leaders Eat Last, which is based on Marine Corps motto. I think it was his book that said, you know, the greatest organizations are the ones that invest in failure.
Yeah.
In other words, you make it part of your calculation that you're going to learn, and learning is painful sometimes. And that because I know he did say this, you know, organizations and institutions that have a zero defect mentality will fail.
Yep.
Because if you live by fear, you're never going to innovate. You're never going to get better because you're chasing numbers and stats to substantiate your existence to a bean counter that's only looking at beans and not actually the substance of what you're doing. And so because that's a way to try to say, hey, I'm an artist, when all you're doing is painting by number. I keep using that reference, but this is an art form. But you can be taught how to become an artist.
Mm-hmm.
In order to do that, you need to be mentored under a master. And a master is someone that doesn't have the end state. The master is someone who learns and then knows, I'm a constant student. As I've said before, matter of fact, you know, my son's texting me now because he just finished a flight. And I just got to read you, you know, here's the language of a true student.
Does your son know you're reading text live on the
probably
air?
From-
no, but you know, all he said was, you know, holy crap, did they know how to break shit? You know, something to, because he's been flying in a simulator today, and so he's today. the philosophy of what he does is learning has occurred.
That's beautiful.
We're going to constantly break shit on you because learning, that's the only way you're going to learn. Matt, he said to me this morning, he goes, you know, he said, the problem with all this learning is that I don't know how to land a plane normally from a simulator. All I know how to do, is land it when it's on fire and no landing gear.
I'll take that.
Yeah, right.
You know, the landing gear's failed. The system's been blown up. You know, the battery's failing and the wings are on fire. That's the only time I know how to land a plane.
Love it. That's how people learn. And that's what you just talked about. People learn when they make mistakes, as long as you're, you know, gently and kindly escorted through the problem and you figure it out and you do better next time.
It reminds me, the book I'm reading right now. I'm sorry, Tony. I'm reading Bruce Lee's, actually by Shannon Lee, Bruce Lee's book, Be Water, My Friend.
Yeah. You can't, you're not going to beat the answer out of somebody. You're not going to get the solution by that.
You'll get an answer.
You'll get an answer.
It won't be a right one. It won't be a truthful one. It won't be one full of veracity.
Yeah.
It'll be a compelled one, and compelled answers are never one. So I always look at this. I always worked with confident human sources and people that volunteered to wanted to cooperate with me, because I always said I'd rather work with 5 to 7 confident human sources give me 120% of their effort willingly than 100 sources give me 5% of their effort reluctantly. Because then I got to verify every single thing comes out of their mouth, which causes more work than if I inspire someone to want to share with me rather than convincing someone. And so the same thing when you're doing an interview, trying to inspire confession, do it in such a way that you don't have to spend another 5 weeks verifying all the inconsistencies with what they said, with what you know is a fact on the ground, and even more so, not just with the facts and data that you know is the case because you didn't give leading questions because you knew the answers. Now you have to verify it against the 3 other people that confessed, which are all over the place. I mean, just I don't know how a prosecutor took any of this. It just makes no sense. Well, it does because of the time, the situation, pressure, and all these things, but
it was a mess that didn't need to happen. And hindsight is 20/20. But the good thing is, at the end of the day, those families can have whatever version of closure you can call it when your daughters are murdered and you find out who it is. I don't know if that's closure, but it's an answer. And those surviving of the 3 of the 4 that are still alive, their names can be strongly removed from, well, maybe you did do it. There will still always be horrible people out there that are not up on what's going on and still want to blame. But at the end of the day, I think this is about as close as justice as we're going to get in this case for the killer who is dead from 1999. It's a horrible case. Yogurt Shop Murders. There we go. Robin Drake, retired FBI special agent, former chief of the Counterintelligence Behavioral Analysis Program. As always, thank you for coming on and giving us your insight in all this.
That's a good one, guys. Great chat, as always.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers Podcast.